This is a special edition of Guildcast, episode 9 for January 8th, 2006. Welcome back, everyone, to Guildcast. I realize I just did an episode last night, but there have been a lot of developments about Chapter 2 that have actually happened since I recorded the last episode, which I actually recorded it 2 days ago, and even though I released it last night. But a lot of things have happened about Chapter 2, so I figured I would do a real quick show here for Episode 9, just to kind of go over and read some news on Chapter 2 that just came out. What it is Computer Gaming Magazine came out with a little article about Chapter 2, where the co-founders of ArenaNet got together and gave us a little bit more news about what to look for in Chapter 2. So what I'm going to do is I'm basically just going to read it straight from the article. I've cut some things out that weren't that important. I kind of just took the key points, and I'm just going to read it, and it'll make for a quick little Episode 9. But I figured I had to do it because this is some pretty big news here. Mike O'Brien, ArenaNet's co-founder, explains, "The original intent of Guild Wars was that people who built up role-playing characters and played through all of the content would eventually want to start using those characters in PvP. We've now seen that many players want to continue to focus exclusively on role-playing content. The solution? Guild Wars Factions, an all-new standalone campaign that features two new professions, a huge Eastern-themed continent to explore, and a much more seamless marriage between PvE and PvP gameplay mechanics. The original Guild Wars introduced the world of Tyria, and more specifically, the continent of Ascalon. Though Ascalon's design arguably breaks the fantasy mold of bearing more of a resemblance to Conan than Lord of the Rings, ArenaNet felt the need for something different with factions. Instead of presenting more Western-style fantasy, the three-nation continent of Cantha exhibits an Asian-inspired motif. We saw this campaign as a great opportunity to explore Asian art styles and cultural sensibilities and to bring to life the great Canton Empire that was hinted at in the original Guild Wars," says factions designer James Finney. "As we looked at the core ideas and concept art for some of the new locations, such as a sea of solid jade designed to evoke the look of ocean waves and an overcrowded city so densely populated that buildings are stacked on buildings, we felt confident that these would be cool and unique places. We get our first glimpse of Cantha in the opening cinematic, which reveals the Emperor's murder at the hands of his bodyguard, Shiro Tagachi. Tagachi is captured and killed for his sin, though his death cry has the unpleasant effect of turning vast seas and forests to jade, making life a little more miserable for the people of Cantha. Now, some 200 years later, Tagachi returns, and the burden of stopping him rests squarely on players' shoulders as they explore this exotic new land. The differences between Ascalon and Cantha become apparent as soon as you step into the Xing Jie Monastery, which acts as faction's tutorial area. Newly created Canton characters must brave the challenges of this lush valley area in order to earn the respect of Master Togo and his staff, who prepare the monastery students for the outside world. The tutorial quests provide a much more comprehensive summary of the Guild Wars experience, even going so far as to include strategic scenarios that pop up in high-level play. One such quest partners up teams of players with an NPC instructor who gives advice on calling targets, avoiding monster patrols, and using other advanced group tactics. Group dynamics aren't anything new to Guild Wars Stalwarts, though the tutorial merely offers a taste of what's to come. Factions encourages group-oriented gameplay even more than the original game did, by offering story-based missions that match groups for cooperative and competitive objectives. In one of the early missions, Courthouse Square, Canton characters must accompany their mentor to Lion's Arch, which current players should recognize as Ascalon's bustling port city. These players meet up with Brother Menlo, one of many familiar NPCs returning from the original campaign, and his party of mid-level player characters from Ascalon. The two groups team up to combat a common threat, and victory opens the gateway between the two campaigns for both players. Another cooperative mission that we managed to get our hands on, the Unwaking Waters, teams 2 8-player groups for a multi-stage battle against a corrupt dragon lord who guards an ancient temple beneath a whirlpool of pure jade. For players with more competitive spirit in their blood, Some of Faction's story missions involve direct conflict between players, putting two groups at odds over a single objective. Players now have the option of joining either the Luxans or the Kurziks, two warring factions that figure heavily into the game's storyline. These two groups collide through the game in missions such as the Jade Quarry, in which two teams of players and NPCs battle for tutorial supremacy over a trio of jade mines. Though the victory conditions allow for only one winner, this mission, and each of Faction's 14 other campaign missions, features a three-tier ranking system and cumulative rewards to measure success. In this way, says designer Eric Flanum, we hope to encourage players to replay the story missions while maintaining and reinforcing shared goals. Now to talk a little bit about the two new professions that have been announced in this magazine article. First is the Assassin. It says, not so silent, but oh so deadly, the Assassin combines speed, magic, and dagger expertise to form one hell of a living, killing machine. Essentially mystical ninjas, players with this professional focus on single-target attacks using twin daggers. Critical strikes are the Assassin's forte. Her dagger skills bring with them a lethal series of chained combination moves, divided into primary, offhand, and dual-strike attacks. The Assassin delivers these blows in sequence for massive damage, and she looks good doing it, exhibiting an impressive assortment of acrobatic animations that chain together along with her dagger thrusts. She can also teleport around the battlefield, foil her foes with painful caltrops, and hex troublesome targets, rendering them unable to block her attacks. Don't expect any kind of warrior-caliber armor, but with this kind of speed and power, who needs it? Some of her attributes include critical strikes, which is the primary attribute. It increases the chance of scoring critical hits and awards the assassin with energy upon a successful crit. Dagger mastery, powerful dual dagger strikes that combo for big damage. Deadly arts, hex spells and other offensive magic. Shadow arts, teleportation techniques and defensive magic. Now as for the assassin's skills, some of them include jagged strike, a primary attack that causes the target to bleed. Viper strike, an unblockable, non-evadable offhand attack. Razor wing, a dual strike that knocks down an opponent who has no allies near him. Mobius strike, when used on an opponent with less than half health, this elite skill recharges all of your attacks. Death's charge, teleports you to your target and heals you if he has more health. Shadow refuge, this evasion enhancer also boosts your health. Critical Eye, increases your chances of scoring a critical hit. And Factions designer James Finney comments, one obvious new combination is the Assassin Elementalist, who can use teleportation skills to make point-blank area of effect skills that much more potent. And now on to the other announced profession, the Ritualist. And it says about the Ritualist, this guy may be blindfolded, but hey, he doesn't need to be able to see you in order to kill you. The Ritualist, who resembles something of a dark savage priest, can see into the ethereal realm and commune with its spiritual inhabitants. In game terms, he's something of an odd mixture of ranger and necromancer and monk. He summons spirits, whose life forces can be used to power offensive magic, healing, and even resurrection spells. He might bind a spirit that absorbs a percentage of damage dealt to party members within its radius of effect, or perhaps sacrifice a spirit's health in order to mend an ally's wounds. From a design standpoint, the Ritualist provides a handy, albeit micromanagement-intensive, alternative to the monk, making for an excellent support character that can fill a wide variety of needs. Now, the Ritualist's attributes include spawning power, which is its primary attribute. It increases the durability of the Ritualist's spirits and other creatures, such as ranger pets. Channeling magic, which is the Ritualist's direct damage spell line. Communing magic creates immobile spirit creatures that the Ritualist can use to power various spells and effects. Restoration magic, which is healing spells and other defensive magic. As for his skills, there's Essence Strike. If you're standing near a summoned spirit, this gives you a quick energy boost. Spirit Burn causes direct damage to the target, magnified depending on how close you are to a spirit. Spirit Rift, a high damage area of effect spell. Channeling Strike causes damage which is magnified if you are holding an item through which to channel it. Shelter, a summoned spirit that protects all allies within its radius from high damage attacks. Pain, a spirit that attacks enemies. Flesh of My Flesh, it quickly resurrects a fallen ally at the cost of half your health. James Finney comments about this, "It's true that one of the goals with the ritualist is to provide an alternative to monks, but primarily we're looking for these professions to find a unique role in Guild Wars. Also, each of Guild Wars' 6 core professions get 25 additional skills and half a dozen new sets of armor. No word yet on new dance animations, but check out a few of the things your character can look forward to in factions. For the Elementalist, many of the Elementalist's new skills put pressure on her target's maneuverability and strength, and are designed to make multi-attribute Elementalists more viable. Some new skills include Arc Lightning, a direct damage spell that bounces to a second foe if the initial target happens to be hexed with water magic. Churning Earth deals prolonged area of effect damage and knocks down foes who are equipped with speed-enhancing buffs. And Ride the Lightning, an elite skill that damages your target and teleports you directly to him. As far as the Mesmer, he maintains his role of layering powerful hexes on foes, removing enchantments, and disrupting his enemy's skills. Some of his new skills include Overload, an incantation that deals extra damage if its target is in the middle of casting a spell. Illusion of Pain, this hex causes massive health degeneration, but heals your opponent when it ends, making it well-suited as a finishing move. Signet of Disruption, this signet can interrupt spells, or if you cast it on a foe that's already hexed, it can interrupt other types of skills as well. Now on to the Monk. The Monk gets, as you may have guessed, more heals, protection spells, and ways to smite his heathen foes. Some of his new skills include Empathic Removal, removes one hex and one status condition from both you and a single foe. Word of Censure, a powerful smiting spell with a recharge rate dependent upon your target's health level. Gift of Health, a powerful health replenishing spell that disables the rest of your healing skills and can't be used on yourself. On to the Necromancer. He gets some new undead minions and enjoys more ways to steal health and remove enchantments. His new skills include Gaze of Contempt. It removes all of your target's enchantments, provided he has more than half his health. Jaundiced Gaze. Sacrifice your own health either to deal damage or to steal health from your opponent, depending on whether he has more health than you. Flesh Golem. This elite skill conjures an animated minion that leaves a corpse upon death, allowing you to reanimate it again. Now for the Ranger, as you might expect, everybody's favorite tree hugger employs some new archery skills, pets, traps, and nature rituals. New skills include Heal as One, a healing skill that affects both you and your pet. Brambles, a nature ritual that causes extra damage and bleeding to an opponent who's already knocked down. Broadhead Arrow, this elite skill dazes your target upon a successful hit. And finally, the Warrior. Guild Wars Melee Master now has more ways to protect allies and strike down his enemies. The Warrior's new skills include Sun and Moon Slash. The first blow of this two-hit sword skill is completely unblockable. Protector's Stance, as long as you don't move, you can block damage from your allies. And Coward, this attack sends a fleeing enemy for a dirt nap. The Luxon and Kurzic factions also provide a handy means for ArenaNet to rope more players into Guild Wars' PvP community, as players can now take part in tense faction war that encompasses the vast majority of Kantha's 55 maps. Player guilds may band together to form massive alliances within their chosen faction. These alliances fight with players from the opposing faction for control of various maps. These tend to be longer matches that encourage multiple objectives, with smaller units within each team working together toward a common goal, Finney explains. At the end of each of these PvP sessions, control of the map shifts, depending on which side won more of its matches. Players can also earn faction points by succeeding in the aforementioned competitive story missions and fighting in PvP arenas. Successful alliances enjoy added benefits that include discounted merchant prices in controlled areas, special areas that no one else may travel to, and the prominent display of the alliance's banner in occupied cities. But will non-PvP players embrace these faction mechanics? Flannum thinks so. We believe that the vast majority of players will want to participate in the faction warfare. We've purposely designed the system to take into account as many player styles as we possibly can. And since there are so many ways to earn faction points for your alliance, we believe it will appeal to a very broad player base. Faction warfare isn't the be-all end-all of Guild Wars PvP, though. Existing guild halls get their own tweaks and upgrades in factions. Player guildmasters can finally add NPCs like merchants and store agents to their headquarters, and much requested features such as the additional guild storage and scrimmage play are on the way as well. For guilds that are thinking of renovating, some new guild halls are available for purchase, including a ritzy Canton Palace and a giant Luxon fortress that towers above the landscape. PvP arenas, on the other hand, get a complete change of scenery. Ascalon Arena, the Tomb of the Primeval Kings, and all of Guild Wars' other competitive areas will soon be transplanted to their own continent, aptly named the Battle Isles. With PvP arenas no longer tied specifically to Ascalon or Kanta, all arenas become available to anyone who purchases either of the two Guild Wars campaigns. Upon reaching Lion's Arch, or Faction's equivalent port city, characters gain immediate access to the PvP continent. And in an effort to ease new players into the PvP experience, this continent also features a practice area where players can experiment, try out new character builds, and train against computer opponents. "We're arranging PvP content in a natural progression," says O'Brien. "New players learn the ropes by playing against computer opponents and later playing in competition arenas before going on to compete in PvP tournaments." Since Factions is a standalone product in a franchise that encourages fierce competition between players, will those who are jumping into Guild Wars for the first time be at a disadvantage due to owning only one product? Finney doesn't think so. "We're working very hard to make sure people can compete on equal footing, whether they purchase one campaign, two campaigns, or even more. We've set aside a subset of skills that we consider the core skills, which are available in every campaign in order to guarantee balance." Finney is also quick to point out that players with established characters get just as much bang for their buck. All of the most unique and exciting additions to the game, such as alliances, multiplayer maps, competitive missions, territory wars, and new items, will be accessible and balanced for existing level 20 characters, and existing characters can come over to Kanta and change their secondary profession to Ritualist or Assassin if they so desire. And Factions just gets things started. If things go according to plan, Guild Wars fanatics can look forward to 2 new campaigns per year. "Our philosophy is to try to make the game rewarding for everyone, however they like to play," Finney muses. "Really, Factions was a matter of looking at what kinds of things we wish our Guild Wars characters could do next. We knew it wouldn't be enough to just have another set of missions to go through. We wanted to give players a chance to leave their mark on the world." So there you have it. That's from Computer Gaming Magazine, the newest issue. Go out and pick that up if you want to read more about it. This isn't the entire article. So this really tells us a lot more about the upcoming chapter. Now, there still isn't a release date. Now, if you go to amazon.co.uk, you can do a search for Guild Wars 2 or Guild Wars Chapter 2, and it has it up there, although there's no screenshots or anything, but it has a release date of March 31st, 2006. I'm not sure if that's just for Europe or what, or if that's a definitive release date, but it's there, and March 31st isn't really that far away. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up this short episode, but I had to get all this out there because it's some pretty exciting news, and I hope to see you all this Tuesday at the trivia contest in Temple of Ages. But until then, tell your friends, tell your guildmates about guildcast.com.